Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
It's Here and Now. Congress is back in session after a week-long recess, and some political fireworks are already on the agenda. The Senate has scheduled several hearings on the plan to hand control of six major U.S. ports to a company owned and operated by the United Arab Emirates. The furor over the ports deal was diffused slightly when the company agreed to a 45-day national security review, but it has already exposed serious divisions between the president and his fellow Republicans. Joining us now on the line from Washington, D.C. is Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. And Rick, I say that this has delay has diffused some of the feelings slightly, but has it? I mean, what are you hearing in reaction to this 45-day review?
Well, I think it hasn't diffused it entirely, not by any stretch. I think there are still a good number of Republicans and most of the Democrats who've been critical of this who are continuing to push for some kind of legislative means. I mean, the point they're making is that a 45-day review by the same panel that already ruled that this thing should go ahead is going to be very unlikely to raise any fresh issues. So I think we're hearing from a lot of Democrats that they're still very much interested in something that would block this deal more permanently or ensure at least more accountability in the process of the review. This is a closed process that is about to be undertaken here within the Bush administration.
Well, and as you said, it's inflamed lawmakers from both parties. What's the sense of why that is? I mean, do you think it is genuine concern over security or politics or being out of the loop, you know, hurt feelings? What are they saying today?
I think it's a good measure of all those things. I think, as the White House has acknowledged, they really misplayed this by not letting members of Congress know what was going on earlier in the process. In terms of the concerns about security, Democrats have long contended that port security is a major area that is being overlooked. Something like 5% of the shipments in the United States are reviewed and scanned at this point, which is a very, very low number. And obviously, Dubai has, at least in the pre-9/11 period, had some questionable ties with terrorist organizations. But I do think that there's a lot of politics going on with all of this. This is something that Democrats for years have been accused by Republicans of being weak on national security, and I think there's an opportunity here for them to really, you know, throw some of the same accusations back.
Well, and in fact, some, including David Ignatius, a Washington Post columnist we'll speak to in a minute, some are saying that the Bush administration kind of painted themselves into this corner with its own drumbeat of fear about the region.
Well, and there's certainly an element of turnabout being fair play here, I think, and I think Democrats do have very, very legitimate concerns about national security, but all of this is colored by the fact that they've been accused of being weak on national security for quite some time by President Bush, and even as recently as a few months ago, Karl Rove served notice that this is going to be the major theme of the 2006 congressional races, that he said Democrats have a pre-9/11 worldview and that they're profoundly wrong in the kind of choices that they'd make. So, I mean, this is a front in a political battle that the president and his allies have chosen.
Well, other issues that Congress will be debating this week, the NSA spying program, the warrantless spy program, and the Patriot Act. The Senate set to debate the Patriot Act today. The Judiciary Committee is to hold hearings this week on the NSA program on Tuesday and Wednesday. What do you expect to see? I mean, are these issues still as of concern, as much concern as they were a few weeks ago, or have they died down? What do you expect to see?
Well, on the Patriot Act, that has died down significantly. There were some changes to the law that were negotiated by a group of Republican senators that seem to have diffused a lot of the controversy, and that is expected to go through rather easily. In terms of the NSA spying, it's still a bit questionable. I think a lot of it has died down. The initial furor and outrage among Republicans and Democrats has gone away and sort of settled into something with some greater review, some pieces of legislation that are out there. But a theme in that one as well is a sense of the White House not involving Congress adequately. I think that's the major theme we've seen develop this year is a lot of the frustration we see from Republicans is members of Bush's own party is and not being cut in on things and being blindsided by things.
And these different issues replacing each other, wiretapping perhaps replaced by ports.
That's right. Exactly. That's the parallel there. I mean, it's the ports are the latest in it, and certainly won't be the last one either. I mean, I think we saw some signs of this last year with the concerns over the presidential security plan for members of his own party. But it gets harder and harder as we move up to Election Day and congressional elections where Democrats are really hoping to make a lot of gains.
Rick Klein, congressional correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's been speaking to us from his office in Washington, D.C. Rick, thanks very much.
Great, thank you.
Well, and we mentioned the bid by the Dubai firm to run 6 U.S. ports. Another story we're following here in Boston concerns the British conglomerate National Grid, which is reportedly buying Keyspan, the biggest natural gas utility here in Massachusetts. That British firm already owns the biggest electric utility in the state. Well, both stories, the Dubai story and the British story, focus a spotlight on foreign ownership and investment in the United States. According to one economist, in a matter of a few years, foreigners may end up owning most U.S. ports, factories, corporations, land, real estate, even our national parks. Why is this happening, and what does it mean for America? Well, we're joined now by two guests to explore this issue. David Ignatius is a columnist for The Washington Post. He joins us here in our Boston studios. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much, Robin.
We're also joined by Washington Post reporter Paul Bluestein. He's in the paper studios in Washington, D.C. Paul, welcome to you as well.
Glad to be here.
And, David, you quote New York University professor, is it Nouriel Roubini?
Yes.
About the amount of capital that foreign investors will own in the U.S. It's just amazing.
Robin, we have been running a kind of reckless fiscal policy, and our Congress, I have to say both Democrats and Republicans in Congress and this administration, have been pursuing policies of cutting taxes, continuing very high spending levels, so that the federal budget deficit widens and widens, and the public likes it. We all like to have money to spend. But the problem is that we are consistently consuming more than we produce. And the effect of that is that we're inevitably sucking in imports. We don't produce enough ourselves to have enough products for all this cash to buy, so the products that are bought come from abroad. And the more that happens, the bigger the trade deficit is. So when people are holding these dollars that they get from selling us products, they have to do something with them. And they're increasingly using those dollars to buy U.S. assets. Well, you know, that makes us uncomfortable, but the truth of the matter is, if they got uncomfortable about holding U.S. assets, if they thought we really didn't want their money and began dumping their holdings, that would be worst of all, because our markets would really take a hit from it. So we're in a very bad position, and at the root of it is what I really think of as reckless fiscal policies by our Congress and the White House.
Paul, David Ignatius is a columnist. He has very strong opinions. When you speak to economists, are you hearing the same kind of concern?
I think almost any economist would agree that it's far, far preferable if foreigners are buying equity, if they're buying, particularly if they're buying what's called direct investments, where they're buying a factory or a fixed plant or building a factory in our country. Because if they're just buying our treasury bills, if it's just debt that they're buying, that puts us in a much worse situation if they suddenly lose confidence in us. You can't dump a factory. You can't dump a utility power plant that you've bought
nearly
as quickly as you can resell it. But it takes time. You don't just abandon it. You know that's something you do as a rather considered long type of decision.
Whereas what happens
with treasury bills, you can do it with a push of a computer button.
Well, and what does happen if China, for instance, talk for a second about China's purchase of treasury bills and how much and what would happen if they decided to push that button?
Well, I mean, the point it's always made about why China wouldn't do that is it would hurt them more than it would hurt us. And it's true, it would hurt them enormously, because, I mean, they hold now about $800 billion in foreign reserves of various types, but those are mostly dollars and mostly in the form of U.S. Treasury securities. And, you know, if they dump them and knock the price down of Treasury bonds, it's true that and knock the value of the dollar down, it's true it would hurt them probably more than it would hurt us. But on the other hand, do we really want to put ourselves in a position where, let's say if we're having a foreign policy conflict with China over Taiwan or whatever it is, where we would worry and the markets would become very jittery over the possibility that China might do something like that? That would mean that we'd probably almost certainly be facing a good bit higher interest rates, and it would do a lot of damage to our economy. So just the fear of it happening could hurt our economy, even if the Chinese don't do anything. So it doesn't necessarily mean we're absolutely going to face disaster for sure, but the risks, I think it's fair to say, are quite substantial.
Well, let's take a look at the Dubai deal, because there's news on that today. David Ignatius, the Bush administration is going to conduct a second review of this deal that would give the Dubai Ports World control over the 6 U.S. ports. Here you are writing about concern about foreign investment, but on the other hand, you also write that concern about Dubai Ports World is racist.
Well, I mean, I think that the fact that a British-owned company that has been managing these six ports is sold to an Arab-owned company, and people immediately begin raising concerns about terrorism, despite the fact that the Arab country in question has probably been our most effective partner in the Middle East in the war against terrorism, certainly in the Arab world. I mean, you know, that does make me worry that the thing that's triggering the immense reaction we saw from Congress is the fact that it's Arab. And I just think we are never going to get anywhere in terms of building alliances and getting out of the real mess that exists now in the Arab world unless we treat Arabs who work with us, who are our partners, as partners and don't go crazy as Congress did in some of the reaction when people try to buy assets or get involved in U.S. business. I mean, this is a global economy, and you know we want to work effectively with people who are responsible partners in that global economy.
Well, and of course, the difference, you know, the concern on the part of many is that it's a state-owned company as opposed to a private business. But today's Financial Times reports that top Arab businessmen, many of whom are U.S. educated, are also very upset, suspect racism. And Paul, what does that do if, in fact, people get the signal that, you know, the U.S. isn't open for business with Arabs?
A lot of Middle Eastern money was scared away from the U.S. after 9/11 anyway because of the Patriot Act. And a lot of investors in that part of the world have been basically taking their dollars and turning them into other currencies and using them for investment in their own region. Actually, Dubai is one of the great examples of that. I mean, they've been pouring money into their own country. So you know, we might be able to get away with it, you know, in this case, because, as I say, a lot of Muslim and Arab investors have been very skittish about putting money here anyway. But certainly, if the message goes to to Asians, I mean, you know, it was only 6 months ago that we were that the United States Congress basically told the Chinese that they weren't welcome to buy Unocal, a California-based oil company. You know, there haven't been serious repercussions from that. But if that message really gets sent often enough, I don't think there's – I think there's certainly reason to worry that there was a very serious risk that foreigners would begin to think that you know, that we're not the great destination for foreign investment that the Bush administration likes to constantly trumpet.
Paul Bluestein, a reporter for The Washington Post. We've also been speaking with Washington Post columnist David Ignatius about foreign investments in the U.S. Both men say that they feel there's an imbalance, just too many companies buying in the U.S., but they still both favor globalization. They say the trick is to calibrate it. We'll hear more about that when we come back here and now. Here and now, and we're back with David Ignatius and Paul Bluestein from The Washington Post talking about the huge amount of foreign ownership of businesses and utilities in the U.S. in light of the deal to give an Arab-owned company control of operations of six U.S. ports. And David, you've said that the U.S. has created this imbalance by relying on foreign investments to prop up the U.S. debt. But you also say that the loss of foreign investors would make the crash of 1929 seem like a sleigh ride.
Well, that's a columnist's hyperbole, perhaps, but I'm not sure that it is. Just to take up the point that Paul was making a moment ago, in the current oil boom, the United States is receiving significantly less of the petrodollar surplus. In other words, this tremendous windfall that the oil producers are receiving than it received in previous oil booms. We're getting less of the money because, basically, Arab investors don't trust U.S. markets. They worry that some congressman is going to decide that their investments aren't welcome or that their assets may be seized or frozen in some post 9/11 kind of environment. So the money's going elsewhere, and in that kind of situation, you could get an accelerating effort on the part of foreign investors to unwind their investments in the United States, as people say in the markets. Yes, they would have to sell those assets at a discount, but they might be so nervous that their assets would be frozen entirely that they'd accept that short-term loss. And I think that is a real worry. I don't mean to overstate the danger of another 1929. I think basically these are interdependent global financial markets. But if people really just took Congress at its word, I mean, look at some of the really inflammatory statements that were made on the Hill when this Dubai ports flap was really rolling. If they took people at their word, they'd think, my gosh, our money really isn't wanted in the U.S. It's not safe there. And they'd do what investors always do, which is look for alternative, safer places to put their money.
Mm. And Paul, you write that while some of these stories leap out at us, as the Dubai ports story did, there are others that don't even get on the radar. For instance, that the Toshiba Corp of Japan is on the verge of buying Westinghouse Electric, which, of course, builds nuclear power plants, and as someone you talked to said, there hasn't been a peep about that.
There's a reasonable argument made that this flap over Dubai ports world is something of an anomaly in Congress's treatment of foreign investment generally, because you know there was a time back in the late 80s, early 90s when if Toshiba had been investing in Westinghouse, you know, had been taking over Westinghouse Electric, there would have been a huge flap because we were worried that Japan was taking over the world, just as we're worried about, you know, about China taking over the world now. The point is not that the U.S. has completely shut itself off to foreign investment. We can't, because as David was very eloquently saying at the beginning of this discussion, we have to have foreign money. The question is at what price? What are we, you know, what interest rate are we going to pay for it? How low is our dollar going to go in order to get it? And the risk is that if we I just think it's crazy to say that there's no risk, as some commentators sometimes make it sound, that we're such a great destination for foreign investment, foreigners will always be happy to put their money here. Well, I think the events of the past week have really shown that there, there could be some factors that would raise that risk of foreigners pulling their money out, causing something like something akin to 1929. I think that risk is certainly not trivial.
Well, and you were also explaining, David, how this cycle works, that more and more foreign countries are buying U.S. companies and therefore making things here, whereas more and more U.S. companies are outsourcing to other countries. And that brings us to, we are having this conversation as President Bush gets ready to go to India this week. Why India? What's the symbolism there?
You know, my point is that foreigners have to have confidence that their money is safe in our markets. We have to have confidence that jobs that end up going to India won't go there permanently, or that other jobs will be created here. In other words, we all have to have confidence that the linkages in this global economy, the mutual dependence, the trust factor is there, that we're all going to end up getting to a better place. If the confidence breaks down, then foreigners pull their money out of our markets. We try to restrict imports from these countries. We get, panic about outsourcing, and the whole thing, I think, grinds to a halt dangerously.
But aren't you also saying, and Paul, jump in on this as well, that the U.S. has to keep an eye on the bottom line so as not to become dependent on foreign investors buying companies here to boost the economy and help out with the debt?
I'll turn this over to Paul in a second, but I just want to say one thing. I mean, the one thing that really worries me is the fiscal policies, the government policies of the United States are encouraging dangerous imbalances. You cannot run a trade deficit of almost $1 trillion a year. You cannot issue that many IOUs willy-nilly to the world without having negative consequences. I think our government is behaving very irresponsibly, and it's time that citizens demanded that stop. The process of the global economy, the links back and forth, I'm all for that.
Yeah. And Paul Bluestein, give us your bottom line. In light of the Dubai ports deal, in light of what seems to be a fact of life in America, that there is increasingly going to be foreign investment here, how do Americans have to adjust to that?
I think we just have to suck it up and get used to it. But, I mean, we have been for the past for the past decade or so, there have been remarkably few flare-ups over this kind of thing. But on the path we're on, the problem is that it's going to increase and increase and increase, because the size of the deficits is so big, and the amount of interest that we're going to have to pay just keeps adding to that debt in a kind of compound way. So the amounts are going to get bigger and bigger, and we ought to recognize one thing above all, just to repeat a point I was making before, that the kind of investments where foreigners come in and buy hard assets, buy a factory, buy an entire company, whatever it is, that type of investment is we're far better off having than the type of investment where they just lend money to the Treasury by buying Treasury bonds, because those they can unload in a panic. If a panic arises, they can just dump them. Mm-hmm. Whereas a factory is something that employs people that they can't unload in a panic. There's a hugely important difference there, and one can only hope that Americans recognize the value of the one as opposed to the other.
That's Paul Bluestein. We also spoke with David Ignatius, both of the Washington Post. And gentlemen, thank you both. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now.
And now, oil prices have stabilized slightly today after last week's attacks on two of the world's biggest oil producers drove prices to over $60 a barrel. Nigeria and Saudi Arabia both had production disrupted by attacks on their oil infrastructure. Last Friday, in the first ever attack on Saudi Arabia's oil infrastructure, two cars laden with explosives were detonated before they were able to reach the kingdom's largest oil facility. In Nigeria, production was cut by nearly a fifth after militants kidnapped 9 foreign oil workers, set pipelines on fire, and disrupted a major export terminal in the latest series of clashes between the Nigerian central government and local ethnic groups. Well, joining us to talk more about how political instability affects oil prices is Amy Jaffe, a fellow in energy studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas. Amy, welcome.
Thank you.
And first to you, how serious were those attacks on Saudi Arabia?
Well, I think that the attacks were very serious, especially because of the target that was selected. The target that was selected is the Abqaiq facilities. And in that complex, something like 80 or 90% of all crude oil that has to export Saudi Arabia has to pass through that facility and be treated. And so had the attack been more successful, we would all be waking up this morning and it would look a little bit more like Hurricane Rita and Katrina in terms of the panic in the market.
And we also, understand that since they've attacked people before, as opposed to, as you said, hard targets, this really shows a weakness in the Saudi Arabian infrastructure, security infrastructure, that we're just not used to.
Well, I think weakness, I would characterize it as a problem. They do have 30,000 troops that guard this one facility, and it's a rather large facility, so it would be pretty impossible to, crash a plane into it and destroy it, because it's a giant, giant, giant complex, like maybe 50, the equivalent of 50 blocks in New York City or something very large like that. I think the concern is, what if they had infiltration? In other words, what if there were enough members of Al-Qaeda or a like-minded group to organize with people from the inside to get in and somehow detonate a very large explosive or a very dangerous explosive like a dirty bomb? Something like that, I think, would be a much larger problem for the oil export facility than what we've seen in the past. Right.
Well, let's talk about Nigeria. Nigeria, the fifth largest oil exporter to the U.S. after Mexico, Venezuela, Canada, and Saudi Arabia. The clashes there between the government and ethnic groups have been ongoing. So how big a threat is the current instability?
Well, I think it's very large because, as you say, this has not been some a sudden problem that might also suddenly be resolved. It's an ongoing, big, wide, broad social problem in the country that has in the past off and on affected production. And in some cases, when there's escalation, instead of it just being a group of individuals, it can sort of translate into an oil worker strike, which we've seen in the past, which can really cripple exports. So that does remain a very sensitive area for the market. It happens that Nigerian crude is a major feedstock in the United States to produce gasoline. So if something were to happen with supplies there, it would have a very boosting effect on probably consumers more quickly than some of the other suppliers.
And the reason we're talking about all of this is that we're reminded what a fragile equation it is. Ted Koppel recently wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and in it he reminded us that the demand for oil worldwide is pretty much equal to the amount of oil that's produced worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, our problem is we're so close to capacity. In past years, say, remember 1990, we had the crisis when Iraq invaded Kuwait. There was a lot of what we call spare capacity. The industry wasn't operating at 95 or 100%. In refining, we were operating at 75% of capacity. OPEC had 5 or 6 million barrels a day of oil fields that it didn't have to produce that was there sort of lying idle. And so in a crisis, you know, these new supplies could come in and replace damaged supplies. Now the whole industry is operating above 95% of capacity. There's no extra oil fields lying idle. We don't have any extra refining capacity in the United States, and it's very tight also in Europe and Asia. So there's really no slack in the system. So the second anything goes wrong, it hits the market immediately.
Right, and things, as we know, have gone wrong. In Iraq, oil production is about 60% of its pre-war levels, and of course Iran is in a standoff with the West over its nuclear program. So there is less, you know, oil potentially coming from those areas. You were just in the Middle East 2 weeks ago, and we just want to ask, how do people there see the relationship between political stability and oil prices?
Well, the interesting thing about having just been out in the Middle East, and I was interviewed like I am today on Al Jazeera TV, and interestingly, the perspective out there is very much different. The question they wanted to ask me was whether I thought the regional governments were doing enough to raise the price of oil. In other words, there's this sense out there that they could get more money for this commodity and have more income to help with the social problems and other issues that are affecting the populations out in the Middle East. And so therefore, the perspective is completely different than it is here. The perspective is really, shouldn't we be doing more to make the price of oil higher?
It's like a parallel reality. I mean, completely opposite of the view from the West.
Well, you know, the way I explain it to people, if you can imagine a president of the United States running on a campaign saying he's thinking of putting down a $5 a gallon gasoline tax because that would cut demand here in the United States, you know, his campaign would be over the second that came out of his mouth.
Even though economists are suggesting he'd do just that. But,
right.
Yeah.
In the Middle East, it's sort of the flip side. If you were to start to say, geez, to sustain the long-term demand for our product, we really ought to let the market come back down to $25. Here's what I'm proposing we do. Again, you'd be out of office there in 15 seconds. And so, therefore, it really is a flip side issue. They're prerogative. They've got opposition movements like Al-Qaeda saying we could get $100 for oil or we can get $125 for oil and we're not doing enough.
Well, and we want to note before we let you go that President Bush has been touring the country, spent much of last week, talking about how America is addicted to oil, highlighting technologies that can break the addiction. How is that message getting across, do you think? And do you think it's possible with Americans to, as he said, break that addiction?
Well, I think the president is absolutely on the right track. We have a lot of interesting technologies. This is not 1973 where we're going to just wake up in the morning and say, God, what will we do? We know a lot of things have been done in our national labs and in the universities. We have new and exciting things we can do in solar energy using nanotechnology. We have interesting things that can be done today in the area of biofuels. And so the question really is, how much resources are we, the United States, willing to commit to pulling those things out and commercializing them? And we see a lot of activity at the state level, but the kind of program that the president has talked about and the funding levels he's talking about is very small compared to the challenge. And so the question really is, as Americans, are we really willing to do a sort of Kennedy race to the moon thing on energy technology, or are we going to, you know, going to wait and try to hope that something sort of happens on its own through the market?
And Amy Jaffe, you inform us as well that in oil-producing countries, they may have to wean themselves from the huge amount of oil that they sell to the West. It's interesting. Thank you so much, Amy Jaffe, Fellow in Energy Studies at Rice University in Houston, Texas. Thanks, Amy.
Thank you.
And still to come, ever wonder what it would be like to sit for a painter like David Hockney? Well, we'll speak to those who did and look at the new exhibit of Hockney portraits at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. You're listening to Here and Now. Revelers are cramming the streets of New Orleans as parade floats stream by in celebration of Mardi Gras. Smaller parades have been running for a week now in a build-up to the carnival's high point tomorrow, Fat Tuesday. About 400,000 people are expected for Mardi Gras this year, compared to 1 million that normally come to town. Also absent from the celebration this year, more than half of the city's 500,000 residents who've yet to return to New Orleans since Hurricane Katrina devastated the city in August. Michael Bruce is one of those evacuees who can't make it back from Mardi Gras. He and his family are living in the Houston area. He joins us on the line. And Michael, what are you doing? Are you watching this on TV? I mean, how are you having this experience from so far away?
Well, I have a lot of it in heart because I lived in New Orleans all my life. So the spirit is there. So I just draw from my past experience and know what wonderful time they're having down there.
So you go from memories and what's in your heart. But,
right. And I see it from time to time on the news, flashes here, flashes there, a little bit about what's going on. I'm just hoping that everything works out the way they want it to, without less crime and without a whole lot of trouble. Just hope it goes off good.
Yeah. And now you're an evacuee. You can't be back there. Many can't afford to go back there. How much do you want to be there?
Oh, well, I would love to be there. That's my city. That's where I'm from. That's my home, you know. But I understand things do happen, so you have to pick up and move on, and because you're still responsible for your family. That's primary.
Right. Well, how do you and your family plan to celebrate Mardi Gras?
Oh, well, we probably go out there tomorrow and do a little cookout or something with a little music from the Hot Eat, the All for One Brass Band. We got some second line music with us, so we do a celebration in front of the house.
Second line, that's the step, the maneuver that the band makes.
Right.
We understand your wife, though, is going a little further than that.
Yeah, she's working at Walmart, so she's going to dress up in the Mardi Gras colors and everything and go and represent the Mardi Gras.
Yeah.
You know, work.
You know, some are upset that Mardi Gras is going forward because so many people like you aren't back in town yet and the town's not on its feet. How do you feel about that?
Well, as an individual, I can understand how they feel, but from a business perspective, and you need revenue in order to move on to take care of some things, if the revenue is going to be utilized for what they say, I'm for it.
Michael Bruce, New Orleans evacuee, living now in Houston. Michael, thank you.
You're welcome.
We want to bring in David Belfield. He's a former king of the Zulu Crew, one of the largest Mardi Gras organizations in New Orleans. He's a lawyer who now lives in Atlanta and joins us on the phone. And David, you went so far as to file a lawsuit to try to stop the Zulus from marching. Why?
I just think that it's insensitive to the number of people that have been affected by this storm, like myself, like Mr. Bruce, who are living in other cities. My heart is with Mardi Gras. I love Mardi Gras. This will be the first Mardi Gras celebration that I've missed since I've been on this earth. I'm just appalled at the fact that the city and certain business leaders think that it's more important to get a few dollars of revenue in their personal pockets than concentrate our efforts on rebuilding and bringing back communities, churches, hospitals, schools, all of which are not open right now.
Well, those officials you mentioned, they say that it's a symbol of a city on the road back and an important way to signal tourists that the city's open for business. You know, it's a one big darn advertising segment that, you know, CNN is running around the clock. Don't you see that point?
No, symbol is the people. Mardi Gras is about people. People make the music, people cook the food, and those people who make New Orleans what it is, they're not there.
Yeah.
Like myself, we make New Orleans what it is. You have a Mardi Gras celebration that's going on right now in New Orleans. There are no hospitals open. There are no schools open. There are no churches open. There are no community centers open. But you're having a party. That's not the image that the nation needs to see. They need to see the fact that the hospital, Charity Hospital, is closed. They need to see the fact that the churches are gutted out and closed, and that the schools are gutted and closed, and that New Orleans is a devastated city. Then people will want to help. It was the devastation that made people want to help right after the hurricane, and it's the devastation that's going to make people want to help now, not parading and frolicking in the streets.
David Belfield, a former king of the Zulu Crew. You know, David, Mardi Gras is all about the huge celebration prior to Lent and giving things up. Are you going to do that this year?
No, I believe in life changes, not Lent changes. I believe that Wednesday's question ought to be, what now, New Orleans? You've had your Mardi Gras celebration. What you going to do now? What now, New Orleans?
David, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. now. British artist David Hockney is best known for his sun-drenched California landscapes, but the 68-year-old Hockney has been making portraits since he was a teenager. He's done hundreds, some celebrities, but more of his family, friends, himself. Now, 150 of them are on display at the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston. It's the first major exhibition devoted to this personal side of Hockney, and producer Andrea Shea took a tour to see the portraits come to life, literally.
We see this portrait of Peter Schlesinger. Peter was David's lover in the late 60s, and this is one of David's earliest California portraits.
Some of us fill photo albums with images of people we love. David Hockney makes portraits, and here they are in oil, watercolor, ink, and collage. Many are as large as life, making the exhibit feel something like a family reunion. And, in a way, it is. I say that because a handful of Hockney's models or sitters are right here, in the flesh, remembering what it was like to sit for one of the world's best-known living artists.
He said, I want you to dress up for this. I really want you to wear a suit. And it was a Sunday.
Then he suddenly said, well, sit right there. I think this might be an interesting piece.
We posed for 4 days, 6 hours each session.
With tea and lunch.
With tea and lunch.
We probably sat somewhere between 30 and 45 minutes. Then he'd say, okay, you can take a break. And so, you know, you'd stand up and you'd go over and see what he was doing.
That last voice belongs to Sidney Felsen. He publishes art prints in Los Angeles and has known Hockney professionally and personally for 40 years. In 2005, Hockney painted a portrait of Felsen and his wife, Joni Weil. In it, they sit across from each other, knees touching, eyes locked. Weil's hand rests on her husband's forearm. She says the image is true.
For me, it captures a lot about the tenderness between us. David's portraits are very formal in their composition in a lot of ways, and you remember the pictures because the clarity of the form and the color and all that. But I think he also is a genius at capturing the psychology of the people that he's painting, and that's why it's so important that he knows the people that he paints.
Hockney has painted, sketched, and photographed his siblings, friends, and lovers, his father and mother, and even his housekeeper of 26 years. Hockney says he's done it for a simple reason.
I've only generally painted people I know quite well, partly because otherwise it seems you might struggle a bit for a likeness.
I'm sure this looks like me. It does look like me, but I look at it, and that is truly where I am in my life right now. I mean, I'm staggered by it.
Jim McHugh is a photographer in L.A. and says he's been friends with Hockney for over 2 decades. Last year, the artist painted a portrait of McHugh and his striking 15-year-old daughter, Chloe. In the portrait, Chloe stands with confidence, to the left of her father, her hand on her hip. He sits, bemused, in a straw-colored chair, chin in hand, taking her in. Chloe, a teenager through and through, says Hockney captured their dynamic at a particular moment in time.
I love him, but I mean, I'm getting older and I'm not permanently attached to him anymore, and I think it kind of shows that really well.
It sure does. It sure does.
And while McHugh is thrilled with the final result, he says it was fascinating to watch an artist of Hockney's caliber prep the scene before he even picked up a brush.
You know, where does the table go? Where do the people go? And, ooh, it's not quite right. It's not quite right. You can feel that fussing and fiddling and struggling to find the right place.
This exhibition is full of real but orchestrated moments. Hockney positions his sitters, but says he also allows them to position themselves. Body language and the space between people are key to understanding relationships, according to Hockney, especially in paintings with two subjects.
When I was doing double portraits, it's interesting how if you ask two people to sit down, just the way they cross their legs will tell you something. Do they connect or don't? Things like that. And I do observe all that and interpret it as well.
In the late 1960s and early 70s, Hockney painted some of his most famous double portraits. A few of them are hanging here, including the iconic Mr. and Mrs. Clark and Percy. It's on loan from London's Tate Gallery and is one of Britain's most visited paintings. Now I know why. reproductions don't do it justice. The large-scale rendering of Hockney's close friends, Celia Burtwell and Ossie Clark, with their cat, is rich with tension and drama, despite its mundane setting. The subjects peer out of the portrait, at the artist, it seems, and you can't help but wonder about the couple's relationship, and also their relationship to Hockney.
Double portraits are the most interesting, in my opinion, because it's about three people, of course. And the triangle's always interesting, isn't it? Not only compositionally, but in life.
Peter Gould knows Hockney's portraits well. He's the artist's dealer. They've worked together for 20 years. While posing for Hockney, Gould says he stared at a painting on the artist's wall. He admits it's odd to see himself that way.
I don't know, I'm an art dealer, so I guess that's how I look when I'm gazing at pictures. I don't look at a painting and look in the mirror, so that's an expression I'm not so familiar with.
Hockney has probably observed Goulds standing just like that hundreds of times. Now Goulds and the other sitters have the chance to see themselves through the artist's eyes.
My name's Charlie Shipes. I have been friends with David for 25 years. I was his assistant in the 1980s, and I've sat for him for several portraits.
One of those is highly unusual. It's a double portrait and a self-portrait. In it, Shipes sits in the background, hands folded on his knee, while Hockney works the easel up front.
He actually was looking in the mirror at himself, looking at me, looking at him doing the painting. And I've watched his work, and in fact, this painting is about me watching him work. He's a masterful person to watch paint. He makes everything look easy, like a Noel Coward or a Cole Porter lyric. And I think there's an honesty about David's work that isn't in a lot of other portrait artists. Intimacy and honesty.
That might be because there haven't been many other portrait artists who have captured their intimate relations with such consistency, according to Stephanie Barron.
It's very rare.
Barron is the senior curator at the Los Angeles County Museum of Modern Art. She put together a Hockney retrospective in 1988 and will curate the portrait show when it heads to California in June.
I mean, most portraitists end up doing a lot of commissions. I mean, certainly historical portrait painters, almost all did commissions. So here we have someone instead who is almost exclusively painting people whom he knows really, really well.
And while he has spent many hours studying his loved ones closely, Hockney hasn't shied away from scrutinizing himself.
It's an odd thing to do. When you're alone and you look in a mirror, you don't sit there smiling, or not for long.
In 1983, Hockney made it a point to draw himself almost every day for 6 weeks. In some of those pictures, he leans over a bathroom sink while staring at his reflection in a mirror, his eyes intense. That gaze can also be seen in Hockney's earliest self-portraits, the ones he composed as an art student in England when he was 17. Hockney has spent much of his adult life in L.A. Now he's gone back home to Yorkshire, where he's painting landscapes of all four seasons. Hockney says the trees are beautiful there, especially in the winter, when you can really see how unique each one is, just like a human face.
Producer Andrea Shea visited the exhibit David Hockney Portraits at the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston. For a look at the portraits and information on the tour, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin.